You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is July 8th, 2020. The first thing I want to do is, as always, thank those who've donated to this show and to me personally. I don't necessarily have the time to respond personally to all of you, but I truly appreciate what you do. And you're the reason that I'm able to keep going. And I thank you very much. Beyond that, the United States is heading towards the abyss. Actually, it is the abyss, I should probably more accurately say. But this isn't the case everywhere in the world. Something that I've been asked to do really since January is to discuss the changes to the Russian Constitution that only took effect on July 4th. These really should, but won't, silence Putin's critics, at least on the right wing, but will embolden them on the left. Some of you may remember, I spoke about this, it was in the news at the time, that in his address to the Duma in January, Putin proposed changes to the 1993 Russian Constitution. And this was not only changes in terms of social life, but also in organizationally speaking. One of the more important things we'll get to more in a minute is the guaranteeing of a living wage. The indexation of a living wage and pension with inflation and with the cost of living. There are 206 amendments total. We can't get to all of them, but we'll get to the more important ones here. This is what happens when a country is rebuilding. Russia is the leader of the free world. The U.S. is the head of the Hydra. It isn't sinking into the abyss. It is the abyss. The Advisory State Council is another amendment. This is a presidential institution that ensures the coordinated functioning of state authorities, and it determines the main directions of domestic and foreign policy. It also affects how Kremlin leaders are chosen, and the process, of course, involving both houses of the legislature. Now, in the West, of course, the concern is to find the good story, to support the narrative. Has nothing to do with what's real or what's true or what matters. All they care about is the fact that Putin could be president until he's, 115 or whatever they're claiming. That is not the issue at all, and that's not even relevant. That's all they care about. They're avoiding the fact, and they're throwing out Putin's alleged power grab to distract from the fact that Russia is building a social nationalist state. The Constitutional Court has to sign off on the constitutionality of any law before it takes effect. So this is beyond judicial review. It's automatic or compulsory judicial review. One of the things that has the left very angry is that dual citizenship is prohibited for government officials. Dual loyalty is absolutely out of the question. What Putin said and his supporters are saying, this amended constitution is to protect Russia's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and to prohibit any attempts or calls to alienate part of its territory. Now, given that he's reset at zero, Putin may seek two more terms because there's now term limits on the president. So potentially he could stay in office until 2036, which, by the way, would be perfectly fine as far as the Russian population are concerned. He'd be 84 if he remains in office until 2036. He's already spoken about retiring very soon. I don't think people realize that power is exhausting, especially in the Russian case. But this comes from the fact that the Russian Constitution really is illegitimate. It's sort of like the German Basic Law after World War II. It's adopted in 1993, and the Soviet Union, I guess, officially dissolved in late 1991. It was written essentially by Western financiers. This constitution is essentially a declaration of independence. The amendments are substantial enough to actually be a new constitution. It is the opposite of how the American Constitution was adopted, where you have one small faction of a faction ruling everything. In the Russian case, there was a national referendum. You know, in the American case, the anti-federalists and everyone else were silenced. The handful of founders met in secret. One group took over. But it seems that about 78% of voters backed the amendments, which is not only an endorsement of the amendments, but an endorsement of Putin personally. The Central Election Commission made it very clear that these were legitimate elections. Putin would have no reason to harm them, since they pretty much stand in line with his popularity, and that these are very populist measures in the first place. But even the European Parliament, Helene Laporte, was quoted as saying, "I can say that the voting here meets all democratic requirements. The right to vote has been granted to absolutely everyone. Even disabled persons who cannot get to a polling place can vote at home." So, you know, but there's no reason for a popular president to fake a referendum with an even more popular platform. The 1993 Constitution was forged in blood. This is when, with Western finance, Yeltsin was able to fire at the parliament in order to take over and create a super presidential constitution to ram down liberalization and privatization, which almost dissolved the entire country. And that's where the 1993 Constitution came from. It's not to be taken very seriously. Very few people do. It's not a venerable document. Americans take the Constitution as a venerable document. I do not. I know too much about it. I'm too much of an anti-federalist to take it seriously, but nor does it have any relevance in American politics anymore anyway. In 1993, it essentially was the result of Yeltsin's coup. People like Andrei Kozyrev and Yeltsin and Gaidar were pushing Russia towards the liberal American sphere of influence, and they were to become dependent on American bankers' money. And the Constitution was adopted just 2 months after he took over, after he shelled and stormed the parliament during the October coup attempt. It wasn't fit for its purpose. It was not a foundational law of anything. It only legitimized Western elites and Washington in particular. That was its sole purpose. It was a disastrous institution, and Russia descended into a decade of poverty, war, and lawlessness. But everything is different now. Vladimir Putin's policies have been strictly Russian nationalist. He is a Eurasianist and social nationalist, and Russia has become a great power. In comparison with Yeltsin, Putin has enjoyed widespread support, not just among the population, but among the ruling elites. Russia is a superpower, unlike the US, but that was not the case in 1993. Russia is far more stable than the U.S. or the EU. So you could say that this constitution is a purely Russian effort, the 1993 version was really a westernized document that Russians really had nothing to do with. Western press has engaged in a fierce campaign to discredit the vote. And it has nothing to do with the actual content of the amendment. That is, this is not discussed. Only has to do with Putin trying to take over as president for life. That's the narrative. Article 79 says the Russian Federation takes measures to support and strengthen international peace and security, to provide for the peaceful coexistence of nations and states, and to prevent interference in the internal affairs of the state. Remember, everything that the U.S. foreign policy establishment says is a projection. The U.S. not only interfered with Russian elections, they created the entire Russian political system. They financed Yeltsin's campaign when his popularity rating was in the single digits. Now, one controversial amendment is the amendment that states that Russia is a successor of the Soviet Union in relation to, quote, assets of the USSR outside of the Russian Federation territory. Now, this has to do with Russia as a successor of the Soviet Union with regard to membership in international organizations. In other words, they're subject to the same agreements. This isn't a new country, in other words. Of course, in reality, it is. It's an entirely different country. The Soviet Union was not Russian whatsoever. Russian nationalism was banned in the Soviet Union. The point of this, though, is to be able to recover Russian assets outside of the Russian Federation. You know, the Russians have already paid the debt of all the Soviet republics, including Ukraine. Russia still has substantial assets within the boundaries of the old Soviet Union. So in declaring this, they have a certain claim to it. In the event that something contradicts the Constitution from interstate agencies, quote, made on the basis of their interpretation of provisions of international treaties of the Russian Federation, the Constitution comes first. No international body can overrule the Constitution. Again, unlike the American. No international decision, no international court can supersede the Russian Constitution. This is actually written into the body itself. So, Russian great power assumptions were simply impossible in 1993. Russia is a real superpower today, while the US and EU are steeply declining. Holding foreign citizenship and residency permits abroad is something that gets the left very angry. You've seen elite Soros-backed politicians like Shashkevili going from Georgia to Ukraine, these liberals going from one country to another, seemingly without a problem. They call it political legionnaires. These states have a very low level of sovereignty. This is officially banned in Russia. And of course, this would include every official in the Russian Federation. No candidate could run if they have previously held foreign citizenship or if they've lived in Russia for less than 25 years. Of course, that does not include the Crimea. Now, the working group, which drew up these amendments, was headed by Senator Andrei Klishas. And there's kind of a strange amendment here. The one change provides for the potential formation of federal territories within Russia, serving either a military or an ecological purpose, controlled directly by Moscow rather than regional governments. The term federal territory, in addition to previously existing Russian federal entities, domestic waters, territorial sea, and airspace, all of which comprise the territory. And the point here, we'll get to this more in a second, but this exists in a number of other countries, including the U.S. But one of the things that the, you know, territories amendments deals with is that this makes it explicit that this also includes airspace, domestic waters, territorial sea, all of which comprise the Russian Federation's territory. So there can be no territorial expropriation or any kind of incitement concerning that. So it's kind of an obscure, it's an obscurely worded amendment, but it has to do with any possible attempt for a corporation or a country to take over using an airspace argument or a territorial waters argument. But this also has to do with Donbass and Crimea. So this strange amendment is connected with claiming that Russia is a successor to the Soviet Union. If any of these sections of the former Soviet Union want to return, they would then be considered territories directly under Moscow and hence would come under constitutional protection immediately. So to be more formal about it, areas with a special status are outside of the normal governing system. These are places like, you know, the Republic of Bataya, the Altai Republic, Ingushetia, the Komi Republic, North Ossetia, Tuva, the Udmurt. These are just a few places that were not mentioned in the old Russian constitution, which now have a completely separate status, officially protected here. So it's Mordovia, Chechnya, Dagestan, certain sections of these, Ingushetia in 1992 separated from Chechnya to remove itself from the growing violence in Chechnya, and they wanted to maintain the northern Ossetia. They now have official status here. So that it's a strange one, but it's also very important. They can't be manipulated legally from the outside. So there's a lot of things that come under that one. Most of the press won't deal with it, but that's what it has to do with. These are often very sparsely populated areas. They're often very contested areas. But as it turns out, this is not a centralizing constitution. More power is devolved than centralized, because Russia is now more stable and it can develop. Putin's centralization measures was a temporary measure, as I stated many years ago. Now, as Russia is stable and prosperous, it can be returned to its more traditional limits. So now the president will be able to dismiss the prime minister, appoint and dismiss prosecutor general, and even in a sort of a veto, stall the legislative process in order to check the proposed bills for their constitutionality, although that's not necessarily a presidential matter, that's a judicial matter. Now, future presidents are limited to two terms. But there is a high level of rotation. Putin is probably not planning to run in 2024. More than, if anything, he would play kind of a coordinating role in the background. And because there are amendments that grant any outgoing president immunity, which can be revoked, but they also can become a member of the Federation Council, which is the upper house of the Russian parliament. But that's nothing new. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, it was granted to Yeltsin and members of his family by Putin's own decree. Margaret Thatcher was in the House of Lords. Now, apart from the former president, the Federation Council will have 30 appointed senators, seven of whom may be lifelong members. And the point of this is a smooth transfer of power and the preservation of stability. So there's centralizing areas, there's decentralizing areas. But as far as his staying in power, Putin's pragmatism, you know, seems to militate against this. I wonder if this is a matter of political insurance. The notion of a lame duck president, as his power wanes, as his term comes to an end, the threat of him staying may force people to take him seriously where an actual lame duck would not, especially in the global arena, which can be very dangerous. Putin has said that he doesn't want to rule too much longer. He said this already. So the Western press, again, is simply inventing things. And I'm hoping that tomorrow we're going to deal with the bounty on American soldiers in Afghanistan, this utter nonsense. The press today is simply inventing stories. It doesn't matter where they get them. All they have to do is say intelligence report, anonymous sources, and they can fill in whatever they want. Now, there's civilizational amendments too. They define the historical aspects of Russia. And of course, they Christianize the political process. And Russia is able to maintain its own civilizational development program. And then Russia becomes constitutionally able to be one of the main poles of influence as the world moves to a multipolar system. This is a fait accompli. But back to the notion of a minimum wage. It can't be any less than the official subsistence level and with regular indexation. And it also has targeted social support, which of course is very strongly supported by the elderly. The minimum wage has to be matched with the minimum standard cost of living, which in Russia is calculated usually by the average sum of monthly utility bills, grocery, and essential non-food expenses all taken together and averaged. And this differs in terms of region as well. And so it's indexed to keep up with inflation. And this will also be applied to social benefits. And then some of these, you know, and then other powers are moved to the federal and local government, from the federal to the local governments, agriculture, certain youth policies, family policies. Something else is the protection and dignity of labor. This keeps Russia from being involved in the race to the bottom in terms of wages. There's going to be more, you know, a strongly emphasis on Russian culture, upbringing, moral education, and health. This is a way to protect Russians from pornography, GMO, and the like. It's a very anti-liberal constitution. Children and the disabled have also been defined as key priorities of Russian state policy. Not to mention scientific and technological progress and environmentalism too. So this is a very diverse group of amendments that appeals to all sections of the population. It is a populist set of amendments. The state will ensure the intellectual and physical development of children and take care of orphans. This is a legal promise now that there is a role they have to play. I don't think anyone else, any other constitution, mentions this at all. And Stanley's upset. Sorry. There is a, when you think about the Greek crisis in 2011 and beyond, social responsibilities toward the elderly is crucial. You can have a social crisis with massive cuts in pensions. In 2018, there was a reform in the Russian pension system that the elderly were not happy with. Something that irritates the left, too, is that Parliament's powers now, Parliament's powers are broadened, which does not irritate them, but now there's harsher background checks on government officials. So all of this comes together with the inviolability of the country's borders and national sovereignty. Nationalism has to be social. Now, as far as Russia being the successor of the Soviet Union, here's what Putin says about this. He said about this not too long ago. This is the other reason that he has to say that Russia is the official successor of the Soviet Union. With regard to secession from the USSR, the Constitution, 1977 Constitution and the previous ones, enshrined the Communist Party's monopoly on power, and the party itself was the core of the entire state system. There were no provisions on the right to quit the party for the representatives of different national entities. The Communist Party held everything. And when the Communist Party began falling apart on its own under external attacks, the entire country followed in collapse. This is unacceptable. This was a delayed action landmine planted back in 1922 amid the creation of the Soviet Union and then in the constitutions of 1924, 36, and 1977. And we have to avoid this. The concept of secession is absolutely banned. Remember, the Soviet Union, there was this form. The Soviet Constitution never meant anything. These are all pieces of paper. But there was a right of secession within the Soviet Constitution. This is something that Russians are overwhelmingly opposed to. This also protects the institution. Remember, another big one that the left is screaming about, marriage is a union of a man and a woman. This is also connected with the children and orphan policy. The obligations to protect children are the same as protecting culture and the unique heritage of Russia's nationhood. And it talks about multi-ethnic nationhood, and by that he's referring to nations like Ukraine, Belarus, Siberia. These were always a part of Russian life. Georgia, some of the Islamic republics, these have been a part of Russian life for centuries. This was all passed by both chambers of parliament in March 11th, but Putin would only sign it if there was a referendum. There was a postponement caused by the coronavirus nonsense. And then the referendum actually took place from June 25th to July 1st. The voting was stretched out to a week to prevent there being any overcrowding. So this is absolutely essential. You notice all of these things merge together. The notion of territorial integrity, the notion of the indexed minimum wage and subsistence, the dignity of labor, children and orphans, as well as the nature of marriage being officially protected as a man and a woman. But these are enshrined in law. Nationalism is maintained through the rejection of secession by any of the Federation's entities. But even more specific things like shifting the power from the president to the legislature. Most cabinet ministers now have to receive approval by the state Duma, the lower chamber, rather than just being approved by the president. Now, there are exceptions, and that would be defense, foreign affairs, justice, and the interior. They're exempt from this rule. So everything else has been devolved to the parliament. On the other hand, as I mentioned, the president received powers over appointing and dismissing prosecutors and constitutional court judges. I've also mentioned the Council of State, where a portion of the president's powers will be transferred to. This will coordinate the work of three branches of government and determine policy in the future. And of course, there is the question of historical truth, of Russia's thousand-year history. There are going to be limits to what the left is able to do. We know what the left has done in American academia. We know what they've invented. We know what postmodernism has done, what the Frankfurt School has done. This is now officially illegal in Russia. There are certain fundamental truths, and this is probably going to be very difficult to prosecute. And these probably aren't prosecutable elements anyway. But the basic fundamental truths of the development of Russia are beyond dispute. At the same time, the Russian language is considered the language of the state-forming people. Other peoples have the right to use their native languages in their own territories. So there's a ban on secession, but there is a acceptance of local languages in their territories. Russian is always the second language. Whatever federal entities they were part of, their languages are on par with Russian. And the Constitution completely mandates safety for all Russia's ethnic and cultural minorities. The multi-ethnic concept has been a part of the Russian Empire for many, many, many centuries. There's nothing new here. Most of the nations that they're talking about are, in fact, European ones. The president, you know, has to live in Russia for 25 years. Prior to that, it was only 10 years. Presidential candidates cannot have any bank accounts overseas. This is extremely important. This is a direct attack on, Soros and Amnesty International. You can't be getting assets from abroad. So there's devolution, but there's also centralization. The prime minister will serve at the president's pleasure. But that also must be done with the consent of the State Duma. But when the president removes the prime minister, that is kind of the default, as it stated, dismissal of the entire cabinet. So it's not just the prime minister, it would be the entire government. This is why the entire government resigned back in January. The Western press made a big deal about that. So it's a big deal that cabinet ministers have to be approved by the lower house. It is possible, though, that if they're not approved, if there's three votes consecutively where they're rejected, the president can appoint the cabinet unilaterally, dismiss the Duma, and call a snap election. Again, does not apply to defense, foreign affairs, justice, and interior. Those, however, have to be acceptable to the upper house or the Federation Council. So this is one of the reasons that people are claiming that the de jure judicial review of all laws is a delaying tactic, not quite a veto, but something close to it. If the president can nominate members of the Constitutional Court, and of course there's only, two terms, then you have something like judicial review, except it is compulsory. So the upper house is always going to be more pro-presidential because the president appoints 30 nominees. The upper house has 170 members. But prior to this, the appointments were only 10% of all. So this can be complicated. This is not an easy set of things here. but every part of this has either been ignored or distorted by the Western press, as you well know. As I've mentioned, the pledge is to preserve and safeguard the historical truth of Russian development. This is a war against, you know, something like critical race theory. This is a war against historic theories, knowing full well that ideas are just as powerful as guns are. There will be certain things simply off limits. The dissolution of the state into you know, self-interest. Now, this is very vague. How this is going to actually function day to day is another matter. But people are put on notice that there is a truth here. There is truth to be understood in history, no matter how angry you might be. And this is being adopted at a time where the American academic class simply invents what it wants, historically. Where the American media, more than anything else, simply invent stories as they come. And they invent stories with tremendous consequences, as we well know. So, initially, the centralizing constitution of 1993 had a lot to do with Chechnya and had a lot to do mostly with privatization. A strong presidential system is going to rule in Russia no matter what. That's always been the case. It's simply too big for anything else to really matter. But Putin is definitely loosening the reins of control. And that's because things are going back to normal. The expansion of the United Russia Party, the embedding of his general social nationalist and Eurasianist influence in every institution, is a mirror image of the long march of the left through all of American institutions. There is no public institution in America that is not officially liberal. In Russia, they're doing the exact opposite here. This constitution is about how society is to be governed. So there was a centralization under Putin to rebuild the state, and now a pragmatic decentralization. And now legislatures are granted more responsibilities as he leaves office. And if anything, if Putin is going to rule, it would be from behind. And again, the Russian population has said over and over again that if they have to violate the old constitution to keep him in power, they'll do it. He's one of the most popular politicians in the world. So, you know, there is no concept of, you know, lack of criticism here. The whole point is criticism. But in all of these appointments, there has to be a consensus. So Botanos is absolutely essential here. As I've written elsewhere, Russia is not oil dependent. I mean, Norway is more dependent on oil than Russia is. Russia's gold is maintained at such a high level that it really doesn't matter anyway. They have so many cushions. They have a huge trade surplus. Needless to say, the European Union has attacked even actually even before the vote took place. The working group, Senator Andrei Klishas, who I mentioned before, who was actually the co-chair of the Constitutional Amendments Group, and this is really, you know, they were outraged at a lot of this stuff, and he stated this. He said, "We took note of the position of the Venice Commission. That's all there is to it. No changes will be made to the law and amendments in connection with this position. The text of the amendments will remain unchanged. The decisions of the European Court of Human Rights should be based on the convention, and it is such decisions that will be enforced. All decisions that will be based on the interpretation of the convention can be enforced only if they do not contradict the Russian constitutional law and order. This is the position of the majority of citizens of the country, And this is what the amendment to the Constitution says. The European Union, the Court of Human Rights, was angry that foreign documents can't overthrow the Constitution. That's not the case in the U.S. It's foreign agreements do override the Constitution. In Russia, that is impossible. Foreign agreements can exist alongside it, but not if they contradict. The EU has never dealt with a nation, even a non-member, fighting for its sovereignty. International courts can't be the first choice of billionaires who want a better price for oil, who want to get out of a criminal conviction at home. So even the European Union had very little to say about it. Of course, they condemned the election, but it was done over the course of a week. The result mirrors Putin's own popularity and the fact that this set of over 200 amendments is a populist, really an amalgam of things that all factions in society can find something good in. But it is a social nationalist constitution. It is a strongly presidential constitution, but with great limitations. It's completely different from that of Europe. But for Clichius to dismiss the European Court of Human Rights this way, yes, we've heard you and we've dismissed you. Again, that's something new in international politics. The European Court of Human Rights really has no jurisdiction except that billionaire bankers do fund it. That doesn't matter to a country that has no debt. Doesn't matter to a country that owns a huge chunk of gold. The European Union is collapsing. Russia and China is rising. And I should mention, of course, that God is supreme over Russia. This is one of the first things that's mentioned in the Constitution now. That was not in the 1993 Constitution. So to summarize, the amendments go like this. God is supreme ruler over Russia more than anything else. There's a provision for the inadmissibility of any alienation of the territory of the Federation. Secession is absolutely illegal, and so is advocating for it. Any government worker cannot hold foreign accounts or have foreign citizenship. This is the other thing that got the Europeans upset. That marriage is a union of a man and a woman. That Russian people are the state-forming people. They are the main group. The official state language in the country is Russian. The republics have the right to establish their own languages next door to Russian. They can never displace it. But Russia is the state-forming people. It is Russia for Russians. Of course, the succession of the Russian Federation in relation to the USSR, which I've mentioned. And importantly, the provision establishing that the minimum wage should not be lower than the cost of living. This is all absolutely essential. And the only thing that the Western press can talk about is that Putin wants to rule for life. Over and over again, that's all they talk about. None of them have actually read this. None of them know what this stuff says. But those that have read it don't want to talk about it. Because these have provisions in it that no constitution maintains. Now again, constitutions are pieces of paper. I've mentioned before that there are states in the U.S. that have a balanced budget amendment within actually written in their constitutions. That doesn't mean their budget is balanced. It just means they have to lie more creatively. There's a law to audit the Pentagon. It doesn't mean it's ever going to get audited. There's always ways out of this. But given a week of voting, you have a huge majority of the population, first of all, went out to vote, and 78% approved it. This is a way that Putin is removing himself from political power, but remaining in it ideologically. This is his stamp as the founding father of New Russia, and he certainly has a right to do that. Now, let's compare this to the American Constitution. Where did this come from? Well, the Revolutionary War was very costly. To pay for it, Congress had to tax heavily, with the new Constitution printed in Nadu. From 1792 to 1811, U.S. per capita tax rates were over 10 times that which the British had imposed on the colonies. But between 1775 and 1790, about half the American GDP was wiped out. That fact means the purpose of the American Constitution was to establish the elite-run common market with the state that had the power to tax it. Revolution gave independence to a new oligarchy in America, now with huge debts, that today would have a very poor rating. America's first year of its existence had over $60 million in debt. They bought debt themselves that may never be repaid. Because of the rebellion of Daniel Shays, they panicked. If he won, they lost. This is why the Anti-Federalists, and actually most of the Founding Fathers, saw the Constitution as a debt collection device. The Founding Fathers weren't just those guys in Philadelphia. They were the founding generation. 1788, an Anti-Federalist 26, and this was actually also published in the Maryland Journal, and the pseudonym was a farmer and a planter. No one actually knows who this is. This is what he says about the new Constitution, American Constitution. Read the said Constitution. Consider it well before you act. I've done so, and I can find that we are to receive but little good and a great deal of evil. Aristocracy, or government in the hands of a very few nobles or rich men, is therein concealed in the most artful plan that was ever formed to entrap a free people. The contrivers of it have so completely entrapped you, laid their plans so sure and secretly, they have only left you one of two things, either to receive it or to refute it. In order to bring it to your snare, you may daily read new pieces published in the newspapers in favor of this new government, and should a writer dare publish any piece against it, he is immediately abused and vilified. Look around you and observe that the rich men, who are to be your only rulers, lords, masters of the future, they're all for it. Shouldn't this put you on guard? Does not riches beget power, and power, oppression, and tyranny? The point he's trying to make is that checks and balances are just on paper. It's a show. The real purpose of the centralized state was something very different. I have no love for the American Constitution, or really the American Revolution. I do have a great love for the Anti-Federalists and for Daniel Shays. Oligarchy was almost immediately established when the Constitution was ratified. As I've mentioned, things like the Necessary and Proper Clause gave the regime unlimited power. It took a few crises to use fully, but that's what it did. Whichever economic elites captured state power would rule without question, building a massive bureaucracy with a standing army at the capital. And these guys were already aware of the power of the media, but they'd had no idea how bad it would become. A farmer and planter said the use of newspaper ownership to destroy debate was already in full swing. Sentinel, Anti-Federalist 21, writes in 1787, "The wheels of the general government having been thus clogged, and the arrearages of taxes still accumulating, may be asked what prospect is there of the government resuming its proper tone, unless more compulsory powers are granted. To this it may be answered, that the produce of imposts on commerce, which all agree vests in Congress, together with the immense tracts of land at their disposal, will rapidly lessen and eventually discharge their present encumbrances, or debt. When this takes place, the note of requisition will be found perfectly adequate to the extraordinary exigency of the Union. Congress has lately sold land to the amount of $8 million, which is a considerable point, a portion of the whole debt." See, the federal apparatus was already a huge landowner. There's really no need for a centralized system to collect debts now that the mode of repayment can be found. But that won't be done. Even if this were to be accomplished, the state would find other excuses to use its power for self-enrichment. Even today, homes are taken for the inability to pay taxes. back then the tax collector would have been shot, and they often were. The Federalist said that would never happen. There's another one, William Petrickin. I mentioned him before, Scottish immigrant tailor, who became a major anti-Federalist activist and, of course, a founding father. Condemns the Constitution this way. From these remarks, I think it's evident the Grand Convention has dexterously provided for the removal of everything that has ever operated as restraint upon government in any place or age in the world. But perhaps some weak heads may think that the Constitution itself would be a check upon the new Congress. But this I deny. The Convention has so happily worded themselves that every part of this Constitution either bears a double meaning or no meaning at all. And if any concessions are made to the people in one place, it's effectually canceled in another. So that in fact this Constitution is much better and gives more scope to rulers than they'd just safely take if there were no Constitution at all. It's a centralizing and debt collection device. That was the purpose of the Constitution. Phrases like necessary and proper are proof. On the one hand, checks and balances will ensure the elites are fighting against each other for jurisdiction. That's the claim. On the other hand, the Supreme Court and Supremacy Clause will cancel this out. Oligarchs can never openly identify themselves and need this kind of rhetoric and wordplay. That's what the Constitution is, rhetoric. Elsewhere, that anti-federalist states that the interests of government are more important than petty squabbles over jurisdiction. With both a standing army and a large civil service, checks and balances will have no further purpose other than to be a show, and that's certainly the case. The anti-federalists were talking about the deep state in 1788, and really at the adoption of the Constitution. He also says in Carlisle, Pennsylvania in 1788, referring to those who wrote the Constitution in Philadelphia. All these wise regulations proved to a demonstration that the Grand Convention was infallible. Congress, having thus disentangled itself from all popular checks and choices, and being supported by a well-disciplined army and active militia, will certainly command dread and respect abroad, obedience and submission at home. They will then look down with awful dignity and tremendous majesty from the pinnacle of their glory, which fortune has raised them upon the insignificant creatures, their subjects, whom they have reduced to that state of vassalage and servile submission for which they were primarily destined by nature. Well, he had no idea how bad it would become. But these were the founding fathers who refused to sign the Constitution. It's not a venerable document. It was kept from public view for a reason. It focused on political arguments, like enumerated powers of the presidency, the powers of the House, but it ignored the economic interests that motivated the convention. You notice that the Federalist Papers don't mention economics at all, and this is not an accident. The Anti-Federalist does. The Virginia Journal of an Alexandria Advertiser, which is a Philanthropos, Anti-Federalist 7, goes like this. What then may we expect if the new Constitution be adopted as it now stands? The great will struggle for power, honor, and wealth. The poor become a prey to avarice, insolence, and oppression. And while some are studying to supplant their neighbors, others striving to keep their stations, one villain will wink at the oppression of another. The people will be fleeced, the public business neglected. From despotism and tyranny, good Lord, deliver us. Everything that we're complaining about today, the anti-federalists talked about then. The government we have now is not anti-constitutional. It's a fulfillment of the Constitution. The Founding Fathers said so. The Founding Fathers is a very large group. It includes anti-federalists as well as federalists. But if you read the Federalist Papers, you think there's no classes in the U.S. One of the anti-federalists talked about classes. The Constitution had just been adopted. And yet these guys predicted what would happen over the next 230 years. They knew that those in the Philadelphia Convention were anything but lovers of liberty, but they were, in many ways, oligarchs who sought to profit from their victory against Britain by using the new federal state to collect debts. And if not they themselves, then those who sent them there. So I'm obviously, contrasting this to the Russian Constitution. Melanchthon Smith was one of my favorite founding fathers, who was a member of the New York Assembly, actually an early opponent of slavery and a founder of the Manumission Society. He was in Congress from 1785 to 1787, and one of the few landowners among the Anti-Federalists, maintained a strictly populist point of view. And he said, debts contracted before the war were left unpaid while it existed, and these were left a burden too heavy to be home at the commencement of peace. Add to these, when the war was over, too many of us, instead of reassuming our old habits of frugality and industry, by which alone every country must be placed in a prosperous condition, took up the profuse use of foreign commodities. The country was deluged with articles imported from abroad, and the cash of the country had been sent to pay them, and still left us laboring under the weight of a huge debt to persons outside the country. These are the true sources to which we are to trace all private difficulties of individuals. But will the new government relieve you from this? Your present condition is such as is common to take place after the conclusion of a war. Those who can remember our situation after the termination of the war preceding the last will recollect that our condition was similar to the present. But time and industry soon recovered from it. Money was scarce, the products of the country much lower than it had been since the peace. Many individuals were extremely embarrassed with debts. This happened that we did not experience the ravages, desolation, and loss of property that were suffered during the late war. In other words, the simple virtues of the colonial era were already coming to an end, and the oligarchy already developed a taste for power for foreign articles. These guys saw the oppression coming. It was an economic issue, not a political one. The founding fathers began to enrich themselves with luxury right after the war. The main problem with the centralized system that the Constitution created was that it created a new oligarchy that had more money and power than they ever dreamed of before, and was much less representative than the British system. Without checks on their power, the temptations on foreign articles are too great. Money was leaving the U.S. and going to companies abroad to whet their appetite, and the new government was going to be a vehicle for making it legal. I've spoken about this many times before. Now you compare that to the nature of the Russian Constitution. As a populist document that was actually accepted by the majority of the Russian people. It has an economic component. It wants to maintain assets of the old Soviet Union while not remaining the old Soviet Union. But the left is outraged because it means now that politicians can't have foreign bank accounts. They can't have one hand in Amnesty International or the BP Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation and the other hand in Russian politics. That is now constitutionally banned. There were laws banning this before, the Anti-NGO Act and things like that. Now it's in the Constitution. This is Putin's legacy. The basic subsistence level is the minimum that every single Russian citizen has to, by law, constitutional law, foundational law, be subject to, indexed actually by a very complex system, as I've already mentioned, average for the country and also for the region, of all the basic prices of goods. It goes from foreign affairs, essentially the concept of mutual non-interference, to special protected areas like Crimea or Donbass, or, you know, part of, you know, Ingushetia, places like that. Transnistria, which are not explicitly mentioned, but is clearly on there. Two marriages being between one man and one woman. The term limits for the president. The devolution of the power of the president when it comes to picking his cabinet. This is Putin's legacy. Now I know this topic has not been an easy one, because many of these amendments are fairly complicated, and one always bleeds into the other one. it's easy to see how enforcement of some of these, especially the intellectual ones, will be maybe symbolic. But the constitutional foundation says that truth is available for those who remove their self-interest long enough to be able to see it. The American Constitution was based entirely on self-interest. Shays' Rebellion was the last hope for the actual American Revolution. The Anti-Federalists were the last hope. And the minute, even John Adams, who I greatly admire, the minute he's made president, same thing for Thomas Jefferson. The Alien and Sedition Acts slapped down all kinds of penalties on dissent. Thomas Jefferson's whole political theory goes out the window when he becomes president. There is no way for one congressman to represent that many people. In the Russian case, rather, the Constitution mandates what an actual representative system would do, rather than try to pretend that this could be done as a matter of law. This is Putin's legacy, and it is I think he's going to be ruling until he's 90 is absurd, which is all the American press wants to talk about. But this is a final manifestation of his political ideology. As you know, my Russia book, Russian Populist, deals with his political ideology, and of course, that book meshes perfectly with these constitutional amendments. So my interpretation was the correct one. These amendments, although not entirely created by him, have his influence all over the place. And because of these laws, these fundamental constitutional amendments, Russia will actually be a representative body ruled by the state-making people, or the Russian people themselves, who the country exists for, and the Russian language, and the Russian religion. The outlying regions, who've been with Russia for a long time, they have their own way of life, but Russia is still the official language. They can use the other one, but the state-bearing people still rules. There can be no question about this. And if this doesn't cause a declaration of war against Russia, then nothing will. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.